by Cosette as he was, he didn't even clearly register that this particular Éponine was Éponine Thénardier, that she bore a name written down in his father's will and testament, that name to which only a few months earlier he would have been so ardently devoted. We show Marius as he was, without embellishment. His father himself was fading somewhat from his heart beneath the splendor of his love. He answered rather awkwardly, "Ah, it's you, Éponine? Why do you say vous to me? Have I done anything to you?" "No," he replied. Certainly he had nothing against her, far from it. Only he felt that now that he called Cosette tu, he could only use vous on Éponine. And he said no more. She burst out, "So why?" Then she stopped. It seemed that words failed this creature once so insouciant and so bold. She tried to smile and could not. She stumbled on, "Well, then." Then she shut up again and stood there looking down. "Bonsoir, Monsieur Marius," she said suddenly, brusquely, then turned and left. A cab rolls in English and yelps like a mutt in slang. The next day was June 3, 1832, a date we must draw attention to because of the grave events that were at that time hanging over Paris like heavy black clouds. As night fell, Marius was walking along the same path as the day before, with the same rapturous thoughts in his heart, when he saw through the trees on the boulevard Éponine coming toward him. 2 days in a row was too much. He swiftly turned off the boulevard, changed direction, and headed for the Rue Plumet by the Rue Monsieur. This prompted Éponine to follow him as far as the Rue Plumet, something she had never yet done. Until that moment she had been happy just to see him go by on the boulevard without even trying to run into him. The night before, she had tried to speak to him for the very first time. So Éponine followed him without his suspecting a thing. She saw him shift the bar on the gate and slip into the garden. "Well, I never," she said. "He's going into the house." She went over to the gate, tested the bars one after the other, and easily identified the one Marius had shifted. She muttered to herself on a forlorn note, "None of that, Lisette." She sat down at the bottom of the gate, right beside the bar, as though guarding it. This was exactly the point where the gatepost joined the neighboring wall. There was a dark corner there where Éponine disappeared entirely. She stayed there for over an hour without moving, almost without breathing, a prey to her ideas. At around 10 o'clock, one of the two or three people out and about in the Rue Plumet, an old bourgeois out late who was racing to get through that deserted and ill-famed stretch, passed close by the garden gate and got as far as the corner the gate formed with the wall when he heard a muffled and menacing voice say, "I wouldn't be surprised if he came every night." The man looked all around him, saw no one, dared not peer into that black corner, and stepped up the pace, frightened out of his wits. This passerby did well to hurry, for very shortly afterward, 6 men entered the Rue Plumet, creeping along the walls, separately and at some distance from each other, looking for all the world like a drunken patrol. The first to reach the garden gate stopped, and waited for the others. A second later, all 6 were gathered together. The men began talking in low voices. "It's Issy Kai," said one. "Is there a mud in the garden?" asked another. "Don't know. Anyway, I've got a meatball we'll make him chew on. Have you got some putty to take out the porthole?"
"Yep."
"The gate's old," added a 5th man, who had the voice of a ventriloquist.
"All the better," said the 2nd man to have spoken. "She won't sing as much under the fiddle, saw, and won't be so hard to mow down."
The 6th man, who had not yet opened his mouth, began to inspect the gate just as Éponine had done an hour earlier, gripping each of the bars in turn and jiggling them carefully. And so he came to the bar Marius had worked loose. As he was about to grab this bar, a hand shot out suddenly from the shadows and clapped itself on his arm. He felt himself shoved back hard from the middle of his chest, and a voice, hoarse but restrained, said to him,
"There is a mutt."
At the same time, he saw a pale girl standing in front of him. The man felt that commotion that the unexpected always produces. He bristled hideously,
Nothing is as awful to see as a wild animal startled. Their frightened look is frightening. He staggered back and stammered, "Who's this hussy?"
"Your daughter."
It was indeed Éponine who was speaking to Thénardier. As soon as Éponine popped up, the five others, that is, Claquesous, Gueulemer, Babet, Montparnasse, and Brujon, came over without a sound, without haste, without a word, with the sinister slowness peculiar to such men of the night. You could see ghastly-looking tools in their hands. Gueulemer was holding the curved pliers that prowlers call fanchons, cutters.
"Jesus wept, what are you doing here? What are you trying to do to us? Are you off your rocker?"
shouted Thénardier, insofar as you can shout, keeping your voice down.
"What are you doing coming here and stopping us from getting on with the job?"
Éponine started to laugh and leaped up to kiss him.
"I'm here, Daddy, darling, because I'm here. Can't a girl sit on a stone these days? You're the one who shouldn't be here. What are you doing turning up here, since it's a no-go? I told Magnon there's nothing doing here. Oh, come on, give me a kiss, my dear, darling daddy. It's been so long since I last saw you, so you're out again, then."
Old man Thénardier tried to get out of Éponine's arms and grumbled,
"All right, then, you've had your kiss. Yes, I'm out. I'm not in. Now get lost."
But Éponine would not let go and kissed him all the harder.
"My dear, darling daddy, how did you do it, then? You must be sharp as a tack to get out of that one. Tell me all about it. And what about my mother? Where's my mother? What's the latest on Mum?"
Thénardier answered, "She's doing all right. I don't know. Leave me alone. I said get lost."
"I don't want to get lost, though," said Éponine, simpering like a spoiled brat. "Fancy sending me packing when I haven't seen you for 4 months already, and I've hardly had time to give you a kiss."
And she flew at her father's neck again.
"Come on now, this is ridiculous," said Babet.
"Let's get a move on," said Gueulemer.
"The cops could come past any minute."
The ventriloquist's voice sang this couplet. "It's not New Year's Day, by heck, to hang off mummy or daddy's neck." Éponine turned to face the five crooks.
"Well, well, if it isn't Monsieur Brujon. Hello, Monsieur Babet. Hello, Monsieur Claquesous. Don't you recognize me, Monsieur Gueulemer? How are things, Monsieur Montparnasse?"
"Of course I recognize you," yelled Thénardier. "But hello, goodbye, shove off, leave us alone."
"It's the hour for foxes, not the hour for chicks," said Montparnasse.
"You can see for yourself we've got a joint to case. Ici go,"
added Babet. Éponine took Montparnasse's hand.
"Watch out," he said. "You'll cut yourself. I've got a blade out."
"My dear Montparnasse," Éponine replied very sweetly, "you must learn to trust people. I am my father's daughter, after all. Monsieur Babet, Monsieur Gueulemer, I'm the one who was asked to look into this business." It is remarkable that Éponine did not speak a word of slang. Since she met Marius, that ghastly language had become anathema to her. She squeezed Gueulemer's big rough fingers with her weak, bony little skeleton's hand and went on.
"You know very well I'm no fool. Normally people believe me. I've done you favors on more than one occasion. Well, then, I've gathered information. You'd be exposing yourselves for nothing, you know. I swear to you, there's nothing doing in this house."
"There are women there on their own," said Gueulemer.
"No, the people have moved."
"The candles haven't, though," said Babet. And he showed Éponine, through the treetops, a light moving around in the attic of the villa. This was Toussaint, who had stayed up to hang the linen out to dry. Éponine made a last-ditch effort.
"Well, anyway," she said, "these people are as poor as church mice, and this is the kind of shack where there isn't a sou."
"Get the hell out of here," cried Thénardier. "When we've turned the joint upside down and we've put the cellar up top and the attic down below, we'll tell you what's inside, and if it's franc, sou, or centime."
And he pushed her aside to get past.
"My dear friend, Monsieur Montparnasse," said Éponine, "please, you're a good boy, don't go in."
"Be careful, you'll cut yourself," replied Montparnasse. Thénardier added in that decisive tone of his,
"Beat it, fairy princess, and let the men go about their business."
Éponine let go of Montparnasse's hand, which he had grabbed again, and said,
"So you want to get into this house?"
"Just for a bit," said the ventriloquist, snickering.
She backed against the gate, faced the six bandits, though they were armed to the teeth and looked like demons in the night light, and in a firm, low voice she said,
"Sorry, I don't want you to."
They stopped in their tracks, dumbfounded. The ventriloquist, though, stopped snickering. She went on,
Friends, listen carefully. It's not on. Now I'm doing the talking. First of all, if you enter this garden, if you touch this gate, I'll scream, I'll bang on the walls, I'll wake everyone up. I'll get you nabbed, all six of you. I'll call the police.
She'd do it, too,
said Thénardier in an undertone to Brujon and the ventriloquist. She nodded and added, starting with my father. Thénardier went up to her. Not so close, little man, she said. He backed off, grumbling between his teeth.
What the hell's got into her?
And he added, bitch. She began to laugh with a terrible laugh. Whatever you say, you won't be going in. I can't be the daughter of a dog since I'm the daughter of a wolf. There are six of you, but what do I care? You are men, while I am a woman. You don't frighten me, not for a second. I'm telling you, you won't be going in that house because I don't want you to. If you go near it, I'll bark. I told you, the mutt is me. I don't care what happens to you. On your way, you're boring me. Go wherever you like, but don't come here. I forbid you to. You've got your knives, I've got my fists. We're even. Come on, what are you waiting for? She took a step toward the crooks. She was terrifying. She started to laugh again. Good God, I'm not frightened. This summer I'll be hungry. This winter I'll be cold. How hilarious they are, these silly geese of men who think they can frighten a girl. Me, frightened? What of? Oh, yeah, that's right, terrified. Because you have stupid tarts for mistresses who hide under the bed every time you start yelling. That won't wash here, not with me. I'm not frightened of anything. She pinned Thénardier with her steady stare and said, not even of you. Then she continued, raking her bitter, flaming ghost's eyes over the rest of the crooks. What's it to me if they scrape me off the pavement in the Rue Plumet tomorrow, hacked to death by my own father? Or if they find me in a year's time in a ditch in Saint-Cloud, or on the Ile de Cygne, in among all the rotten old cork floats and drowned dogs? Here she was forced to break off. A dry cough took hold of her. Her breathing came out like a rattle from her narrow, frail chest. She went on. All I have to do is scream. They'll come running. Whoosh! There are six of you, but I am the rest of the world. Thénardier made a move toward her. Get back! She cried. He stopped and said to her gently, all right. I won't come any closer, but there's no need to shout. So then, my girl, you want to stop us working? But we've got to earn our living. Aren't we friends anymore, then? You annoy me, said Éponine. But we've got to live, got to eat, drop dead. That said, she plonked down on the base of the gate and began quietly singing. My arms so plump, my legs so shapely, and time won't come again. She was leaning with her elbow propped on her knee and her chin in her hand and swinging her foot in an attitude of complete indifference. Her dress was full of holes and showed her sharp collarbones. The street lamp nearby lit up her face and her body. Nobody could look more resolute and amazing. The six assassins, dumbstruck and dark at being held in check by a mere girl, darted under the long shadow cast by the lamp and held a conference full of furious and humiliated shrugs. She watched them, but with a calm and savage air. There's something up with her, said Babet. Some reason. Do you reckon she's fallen in love with the mutt? It'd be a shame to miss out on this, but two women, an old man who lives out the back, there are plenty of good curtains at the windows. The old boy'd have to be a Jewbag. Looks like a safe bet to me. Well then, in you go, the rest of you, cried Montparnasse. Do the business. I'll stay here with the girl. And if she moves a muscle... He flashed the switchblade that he held open up his sleeve in the light of the street lamp. Thénardier did not say a word and seemed ready to be led. Brujon, who was a bit of an oracle and who had, as we know, set the job up, had still not spoken. He seemed to be thinking. He had the reputation of not backing away from anything, and it was known that he had one day, out of sheer bravado, done over a police station. On top of that, he made up verses and songs which gave him great authority. Babet questioned him. You don't say anything, Brujon? Brujon remained silent a moment more. Then he shook his head in several different ways and finally decided to speak. This is the thing. I came across two sparrows fighting this morning. This evening, I bang into a woman arguing. All this is bad. Let's clear out. They cleared out. While clearing out,
Montparnasse muttered. All the same, if they'd wanted me to, I'd have finished her off.
Babet responded, Not me. I don't touch women.
At the corner of the street they stopped and engaged in this puzzling dialogue in muted voices.
Where are we going to sleep tonight?
Underneath Pantin.
Have you got the gate key on you, Thénardier?
Ah, hell.
Éponine, who had not taken her eyes off them, saw them turn back the way they had come. She got up and started to creep behind them, hugging the walls and houses. She followed them in this fashion as far as the boulevard. There they split up, and she saw those six men sink into the darkness, where they seemed to melt. Things of the night. After the crooks had gone, the Rue Plumet resumed its quiet nocturnal appearance. What had just happened in this street would not have amazed a forest. Timberland, thickets, ferns, heather, fiercely entangled branches, tall grasses, lead their own dark lives. Wild, teeming nature suddenly catches glimpses of the invisible there. What is below man makes out through the mist what is above man. And things we, the living, know nothing about, confront each other in the night. Bristling, musky nature is startled by certain approaches in which it believes it gets a whiff of the supernatural. The forces of darkness know each other and have mysterious checks and balances among themselves. Teeth and claws dread the intangible. Bloodthirsty bestiality, starving voracious appetites in quest of prey, instincts armed with nails and jaws whose only source and goal is the stomach, anxiously watch and scent the imperturbable spectral shape prowling under a shroud, standing in its filmy, rustling dress, and seeming to them to live a dead and terrible life. These brutal things, which are merely matter, vaguely fear having to deal with the immense darkness condensed in an unknown being. A black figure barring the way stops the wild beast in its tracks. What emerges from the graveyard intimidates and disconcerts what emerges from the lair. The ferocious is frightened of the sinister. Wolves back away when they come upon a ghoul. Marius falls to earth and gives Cosette his address. While this species of bitch with a human face mounted guard against the gate and the six bandits were giving in, outmaneuvered by a girl, Marius was by Cosette's side. Never had the sky been more starry and enchanting, the trees more tremulous, the smell of the grass more pungent. Never had the birds gone to sleep in among the leaves with a sweeter twittering. Never had all the harmonies of universal serenity better answered the inner music of love. Never had Marius been more in love, happier, more enraptured. But he had found Cosette sad. Cosette had been crying, her eyes were red. This was the first cloud in this wonderful dream. Marius's first words had been, What's wrong? And she had replied, This. Then she had sat down on the bench by the steps, and while he took his place, all a tremble beside her, she had expanded. My father told me this morning to get ready, that he had business to attend to and that we might perhaps be going away. Marius shuddered from head to toe. When you are at the end of life, dying means going away. When you are at the beginning of life, going away means dying. For 6 weeks now, Marius had, little by little, slowly, by degrees, been taking possession of Cosette each day. An ideal but thorough possession. As we've already explained, with first love, you take the soul well before the body. Later on, you take the body well before the soul. Sometimes, you don't take the soul at all. The Faublas and the Prudhomme add, because there isn't one. But happily, this bit of sarcasm is a blasphemy. Marius, then, possessed Cosette the way minds possess in spirit. But he wrapped her round with all his soul and held her jealously to him with incredible conviction. He possessed her smile, her breath, her scent, the deep radiance of her blue eyes, the softness of her skin when he touched her hand, the lovely mark she had on her neck, her every thought. They had vowed never to sleep without dreaming of the other, and they had kept their word. And so he possessed her every dream, too. He gazed endlessly at the tiny hairs on the back of her neck, which he sometimes brushed with his breath. And he told himself that there was not one of those tiny hairs that did not belong to him, Malleus. He contemplated and adored the things she wore, her ribbons and bows, her gloves, her cuffs, her brodequin, as sacred objects of which he was master. He felt he was lord of the pretty tortoise-shell combs she wore in her hair, and he even told himself, muffled and confused stammerings of dawning desire, that there was not a thread of her dress, not a stitch of her stockings, not a tuck of her corset, that was not his. By Cosette's side, he felt himself to be by his property, by his possession, by his despot and his slave. It felt as though their souls had so merged that if they had wanted to take them back again, they could not possibly have distinguished between them. "This one is mine. No, it's mine. I assure you, you're mistaken. This is me all over. What you take for you is me." Marius was part of Cosette, and Cosette was part of Marius. Marius could feel Cosette living in him. To have Cosette, to possess Cosette, was no different for him from breathing. It was into the midst of this faith, of this intoxication, of this virginal possession, amazing and absolute, of this sovereignty, that these words, "We are going away," fell suddenly, and the abrupt voice of reality cried out to him, "Cosette is not yours." Marius woke up. For 6 weeks he had lived, as we said, outside life. Those words, "going away," brought him down to earth with a thud. He was lost for words. Cosette felt only that his hand was cold. It was her turn to say, "What's wrong?" He replied, so low that Cosette could hardly hear him, "I don't understand what you mean." She recapitulated. "This morning my father told me to pack all my things and get ready, that he would give me his clothes to pack in a trunk, that he was obliged to go on a trip, that we were going away, that we needed a big trunk for me and a little one for him, and to get all that ready within a week from now, that we would perhaps go to England." "But that's monstrous," cried Marius. It is certain that at that moment, to Marius's mind, no abuse of power, no violence, no abomination of the most extravagant tyrants, no act of Bucyrus, Tiberius, or Henry VIII was equal in ferocity to this. Monsieur Fauchelevent's taking his daughter off to England because he had business to attend to. He asked in a weak voice, "And when would you leave?" He didn't say when. "And when would you come back?" He didn't say when. Marius shot to his feet and said coldly, "Cosette, are you going?" Cosette turned her beautiful eyes full of anguish toward him and answered in a baffled voice, "Where? To England are you going? Why are you talking to me in that tone? I'm asking you whether you're going." "What do you expect me to do?" she said, clasping her hands together. "So you'll go?" "If my father goes, so you'll go." Cosette took Marius's hand and squeezed it without answering. "Fine," said Marius. "Then I'll go elsewhere." Cosette felt the meaning of these words even more than she understood them. She went so pale that her face became white in the dark. She stammered, "What do you mean?" Marius looked at her, then slowly raised his eyes to the sky and answered, "Nothing." When he lowered his gaze again, he saw that Cosette was smiling at him. The smile of the woman you love has a brightness you can see at night. "What idiots we are. Marius, I've got an idea."
"What?"
"You go too, if we're going. I'll tell you where. You can come and join me, wherever I am."
Marius was now wide awake. He had come back to reality. He shouted at Cosette,
"Go with you? Are you mad? That'd take money, and I don't have any. Go to England? But I now owe, I don't know, over 10 louis to Courfeyrac, a friend of mine you don't know. I've got an old hat that's not worth 3 francs. I have a coat that has buttons missing in front. My shirt's all torn. I've got holes at the elbows. My boots let in water. For 6 weeks I haven't thought about all that, and I haven't told you about it, Cosette. I'm a pauper. You only see me at night, and you give me your love. If you saw me in daylight, you'd give me a sou. Go to England? How? I don't even have the money for a passport."
He threw himself against a tree that happened to be there, and stood with both arms above his head, his forehead against the bark, feeling neither the wood scraping his skin, nor the fever hammering at his temples, motionless, ready to fall like the very statue of despair. He stayed in that position for a long time. A person could spend eternity in such bottomless pits. Finally, he turned round. He heard a small, stifled sound behind him, soft and sad. It was Cosette, sobbing. She'd been crying for close to 2 hours right next to Marius, while he had been lost in thought. He went to her, fell on his knees, and slowly prostrating himself, took the tip of her foot which peeped out from under her dress, and kissed it. She let him do this in silence. There are moments when a woman accepts the religion of love like a gloomy and resigned goddess. "Don't cry," he said. She murmured, "But I might be going away, and you can't come." He said, "Do you love me?" She answered him, sobbing these words straight from paradise that are never more thrilling than when said through tears, "I adore you." He went on in a tone of voice that was an inexpressible caress, "Don't cry. Tell me, will you do that for me and not cry?" "Do you love me?" she said. He took her hand. "Cosette, I have never given my word of honor to anyone because my word of honor frightens me. I feel that my father is there, looking over my shoulder, and yet I give you my most sacred word of honor that if you go away, I will die." There was in the tone in which he uttered those words a melancholy so solemn and so calm that Cosette shook. She felt the chill that something somber and true gives off as it passes. She stopped crying from shock. "Now listen," he said. "Don't expect me tomorrow." "Why not?" "Don't expect me until the day after tomorrow." "Oh, why not?" "You'll see." "A day without seeing you. I couldn't stand it." "We can sacrifice one day, if it means spending our whole lives together." Then Marius added, in a whisper as though to himself, "He is a man who never changes his habits, and he has never received anyone except at night."
"What man are you talking about?" asked Cosette.
"Me? I didn't say anything."
"What are you hoping for, then?"
"Wait till the day after tomorrow."
"Is that what you want?"
"Yes, Cosette." She took his head in both hands, stood on tiptoe to be at his height, and tried to see the hope in his eyes. Marius went on. "I've been thinking. You should know my address. Anything could happen, you never know. I live at that old friend of mine's, Courfeyrac, Rue de la Verrerie, number 16. He fumbled in his pocket, pulled out a penknife, and with the blade wrote on the plaster of the wall, 16, Rue de la Verrerie. Cosette, meanwhile, was looking intently into his eyes again.
"Tell me what you are thinking, Marius. You are thinking something. Tell me what it is. Oh, tell me, so I can get to sleep tonight."
"What I'm thinking is this, that God can't possibly want to separate us. Wait for me the day after tomorrow."
"What will I do till then?" said Cosette. "It's all right for you. You're out and about. You can come and go. Men are so lucky. Me, I'll be all on my own. I'll be so sad. What will you do tomorrow night, then? Tell me."
"I'm going to try something."
"Then I'll pray to God and I'll think of you all the time, from now till then, so you are sure to succeed. I won't ask you any more questions. You are my master. I'll spend tomorrow night singing that music from Euryanthe that you love. You came and listened to it one night outside my shutters. But come early the day after tomorrow. I'll expect you at 9 o'clock on the dot, I warn you. My God, how sad that the days are so long. 9 o'clock sharp, you hear me? I'll be in the garden."
"I will too." And without a word, moved by the same thought, driven by the same electric currents that put two lovers in perpetual contact, both of them dizzy with desire even in their misery, they fell into each other's arms, without realizing that their lips were joined, while their uplifted eyes, overflowing with ecstasy and tears, were fixed on the stars. When Marius left, the street was deserted. At that precise moment, Éponine had tracked the burglars as far as the boulevard. while Marius had been daydreaming, with his head against the tree, an idea had flashed through his mind. An idea, alas, that he himself judged outrageous and unthinkable. He had decided on a desperate course of action. Old heart and young heart, face to face. Old man Gillenormand had now long since turned 91. He was still living with Mademoiselle Gillenormand at number 6 Rue de Filles du Calvaire in the old house that belonged to him. He was, as you will recall, of that antique race of old men who await death perfectly erect, whom age burdens without buckling, and whom even sorrow does not bow. Yet for some little time his daughter had been saying, "My father is going downhill." He no longer slapped the servants. He no longer banged his cane with the same verve on the stair landing when Basque was slow to open the door for him. For the past 6 months, the July Revolution had hardly ruffled his feathers at all. He had seen in the Moniteur, almost with tranquillity, this coupling of words, "Monsieur, un bleu, comte, peer of France." The fact is that the old man was filled with despair. He did not sag. He did not surrender. That was no more in his physical makeup than in his moral makeup. But he felt himself inwardly disintegrating. For 4 years he had been waiting for Marius, resolutely, that is indeed the right word, in the conviction that the naughty little rascal would ring at his door one of these days. Now he had reached the point where, at certain mournful hours, he told himself that if Marius took his time, even a little longer, it wasn't death that he found unbearable, it was the idea that he might never see Marius again. Never to see Marius again. That had never, even for a moment, entered his head until now. But now the idea was beginning to occur to him, and it sent shivers down his spine. Absence, as always happens with emotions that are natural and true, only increased the love the grandfather felt for the ungrateful boy who had taken himself off like that. It is on nights in December, when the temperature drops below zero, that we most think of the sun. Monsieur Gillenormand was, or thought he was, utterly incapable of making a move, he, the grandfather, toward his grandson. "I'd sooner croak," he said. He did not think himself in the wrong in any way, but he never thought of Marius except with deep affection and the mute despair of an old man with one foot in the grave. He was beginning to lose his teeth, which added to his sadness. Though he never admitted it to himself, for it would have made him furious and ashamed, Monsieur Gillenormand had never loved any mistress the way he loved Marius. He had them hang in his bedroom, on the wall opposite his bed, as the first thing he would see when he woke up, an old portrait of his other daughter, the one who had died, Madame Pommerci, a portrait done when she was 18 years old. He never tired of looking at this portrait. One day, while he was studying it, he happened to say, "I think it's a good likeness." "Of my sister?" asked Mademoiselle Gillenormand. "Why, yes, it is," the old man added, "and of him, too." Once, as he was sitting with his knees pressed together and his eyes almost closed, in an attitude of dejection, his daughter ventured to say to him, "Father, do you still bear as much of a grudge as ever toward—" She broke off, not daring to go any further. "Who?" "That poor Marius." He lifted his old head, slammed his bony, wrinkled old fist on the table, and shouted in his crabbiest and most ringing voice, "Poor Marius, you say? That gentleman is a bounder, a nasty little rotter, an ungrateful upstart, with no heart, no soul, a puffed-up popinjay, a bad piece of work." And he turned away so that his daughter could not see the tears that had welled up in his eyes. 3 days later, he emerged from a silence that had lasted for 4 hours to tell his daughter point-blank, "I have the honor of beseeching Mademoiselle Gillenormand never to speak to me of him again." Aunt Gillenormand gave up all attempts and arrived at this profound diagnosis. "My father never loved my sister much after her silly mistake. It is clear he detests Marius." "After her silly mistake" meant after she married the colonel. Still, as you might well have surmised, Mademoiselle had failed in her attempt to substitute her favorite the officer of the Lancers, for Marius. Théodule had not taken as a replacement. Monsieur Gillenormand had not accepted the quid pro quo. A hole in the heart is not satisfied with a stopgap. Théodule, for his part, even with his nose on the inheritance, rebelled at the chore of pleasing. The old man bored the Lancer, and the Lancer disgusted the old man. Lieutenant Théodule was doubtless cheery but chatty, frivolous but common, a bon vivant but one who mixed with a bad crowd. He had mistresses, it is true, and he talked about them a lot, also true, but he said nasty things about them. All his good points had their bad points. Monsieur Gillenormand was exasperated at his tales of casual amorous encounters near his barracks in the Rue de Babylone, and then again, Lieutenant Gillenormand sometimes turned up in his uniform with the tricolor cockade. This made him quite simply insupportable. Old man Gillenormand had wound up telling his daughter, "I've had enough of Théodule. You receive him if you like. I don't have much time for men of war in times of peace. I don't know if I don't prefer sabreurs to saber-draggers. The clattering of blades in battle is less pathetic, after all, than the racket scabbards make tapping on the pavement, and then arching his back like a swashbuckler and lacing himself up like a sissy. Fancy wearing a corset under a cuirass. It's too ridiculous for words. When you are a real man, you keep an equal distance from bravado and simpering affectation. Neither a braggart nor a pretty boy. You can keep your Théodule to yourself." His daughter could try as she might to tell him, "But he is your grand-nephew, after all." It turned out that Monsieur Gillenormand, a grandfather to his fingertips, was no great-uncle at all. Basically, as he was of sound mind and could make comparisons, Théodule only served to make him miss Marius all the more. One evening, it was the 4th of June, though that did not stop old Gillenormand from having a roaring fire going in his fireplace, he had dismissed his daughter, who was quietly sewing in the next room. He was alone in his room, with the pastoral scenes, his feet up on his fire dogs, half wrapped round in his vast 9-panel Coromandel screen, leaning on his table where 2 candles burned under a green shade, swallowed up in his tapestry armchair, a book in his hand, but not reading. He was decked out in his usual style, as an incroyable, a dandy, and he looked like an antique portrait of Garat. This would have caused him to be followed in the street, but his daughter always bundled him up whenever he went out in a vast quilted bishop's overcoat that hid his clothes. At home, except when he got up or went to bed, he never wore a dressing gown. "They make a man look old," he said. Old Gillenormand was thinking of Marius lovingly and bitterly, and as usual, bitterness dominated. His embittered tenderness always ended up boiling over into outrage. He had reached the point where you try to come to grips with and accept what is tearing you apart. He was busy explaining to himself that there was no longer any reason for Marius to come back, that if he had needed to come back, he would have done so already, that he had to give up hoping for that. He tried to get used to the idea that it was over, and that he would die without seeing that gentleman again. But his whole nature rebelled. His old paternal feelings could not allow it. "I don't believe it," he said. It was his painful refrain. "I don't believe he's never coming back." His bald head had sunk onto his chest, and he vaguely leveled at the ashes in his hearth a woeful yet cranky glance. As he was in the depths of his reverie, his old servant Basque came in and asked him, "Is Monsieur able to receive Monsieur Marius?" The old man jerked upright, ashen, and like a corpse jumping under a galvanic shock. All his blood had rushed to his heart. He stammered, "Monsieur Marius what?"
"I don't know," answered Basque, intimidated and thrown by his master's look. "I didn't see him. It was Nicolette who came and told me that there is a young man, and to say that it's Monsieur Marius."
Old Gillenormand stuttered in a voice just above a whisper, "Show him in." And he remained in the same position, his head wobbly, his eyes riveted to the door. It opened again. A young man entered. It was Marius. Marius stopped at the door as if waiting to be asked in. His almost wretchedly shabby get-up could not be seen in the obscurity created by the lampshade. Only his face could be made out, calm and grave, but strangely sad. Old Gillenormand, overcome with amazement and joy, remained so dazzled for a few moments he was unable to see anything more than a bright light, as when you are confronted by an apparition. He was ready to pass out. He saw Marius through a blinding haze. It really was him, it really was Marius. At last, after 4 years, he seized him, so to speak, sized him up in a single glance. He found him handsome, noble, distinguished, grown up, a mature man with a correct demeanor and a charming air. He wanted to open his arms, to call him, to run to him. His heart was melting in ravishment. Affectionate words welled up inside him and overflowed from his breast. Finally, all this tenderness made itself felt and reached his lips. But out of that warring urge that was the very basis of his nature, harsh words came out. He said abruptly, "What have you come here for?" Marius answered, embarrassed, "Monsieur..." Monsieur Gillenormand would have liked Marius to throw himself into his arms. He was annoyed with Marius and with himself. He felt he was being brusque and that Marius was being cold. It was for the old man an unbearable and infuriating anxiety to feel himself so loving and so tearful inside, yet not to be able to be anything but hard on the outside. His bitterness returned. He interrupted Marius in a gruff tone.
"So, why are you here?"
That "so" signified, "if you have not come to give me a hug and a kiss." Marius looked at his grandfather, whose pallor had turned his face to marble.
"Have you come to say you're sorry? Do you admit now that you were wrong?"
He thought he was putting Marius on the right track and that the boy was about to give in. Marius flinched. He was being asked to disown his father. He looked at the floor and answered, "No, monsieur."
"Well, then," cried the old man impetuously, with a pain that was poignant and full of anger, "what do you want with me?"
Marius clasped his hands, took a step forward, and said in a weak and quivering voice, "Monsieur, have pity on me." These words stirred Monsieur Gillenormand. If they'd been said earlier, he would have relented, but they came too late. The grandfather got up. He leaned on his walking stick with both hands. His lips were white. His head wobbled. But he dominated the bowed Marius with his height.
"Pity on you, monsieur? It's the adolescent asking for pity from the old man of 91. You are just starting out in life. I'm about to leave it. You go off to shows, to balls, to cafes, to billiards. You're witty, you please the ladies, you're a good-looking boy. I sit there, spitting on my embers in the middle of summer. You are rich, with the only riches that count. I've got all the impoverishments of old age, infirmity, isolation. You've got all your 32 teeth, a good stomach, a keen eye, strength. I don't even have white hair now. I've lost my teeth. I'm losing my legs. I'm losing my memory. There are 3 street names I always get wrong. The Rue Charlot, the Rue du Chaume, and the Rue Saint-Claude. That's where I am at. You have the whole future before you, full of sunshine, while I can hardly see what's in front of my nose anymore. I've gone so far into the night. You're in love, that goes without saying. I'm not loved by anyone in the world, and you ask me for pity. By Jove, Molière overlooked this one. If this is how you jest at the Palais, you lawyers, I offer you my sincere compliments. You are true comedians."
And the old man went on, in a voice both wrathful and grave.
"Right then, what do you want from me?"
"Monsieur," Marius said, "I know that my presence annoys you, but I've only come to ask you for one thing, and then I will go at once."
"You are a noodle," said the old man. "Who said you were to go?"
This was a translation of the tender words in his innermost heart. Just say you're sorry, why don't you? Throw your arms around my neck. Monsieur Gillenormand realized that Marius would leave him in a few moments, that his unpleasant welcome had put him off, that his harshness was driving him away. He told himself all that, and his pain only intensified, and since pain for him turned immediately to anger, his harshness only intensified. He wanted Marius to understand, but Marius did not understand, which made the old man furious. He went on.
Really? You deserted me? Me? Your grandfather? You left my house to go God knows where. You upset your aunt. You've gone and led, one can very well guess it's much more fun, the life of a bachelor, playing the fop, coming home at all hours, kicking up your heels. You haven't given me the slightest sign of life. You've run up debts without even telling me to pay them. You've turned yourself into a smasher of windows and a rowdy hooligan, and now, after 4 long years, you turn up on my doorstep, and this is all you have to say to me.
This violent way of pushing his grandson into a show of affection produced only silence with Marius. Monsieur Gillenormand folded his arms, a gesture that, with him, was particularly imperious, and he spat out bitterly at Marius.
Let's get it over with. You've come to ask me something, you say? Well, then, what? What is it? Speak.
Monsieur, said Marius, with the look of a man knowing he is about to plummet over a precipice, I've come to ask your permission to marry. Monsieur Gillenormand rang. Basque cracked the door open.
Send my daughter in.
A second later the door opened again. Mademoiselle Gillenormand did not come in, but showed herself at the doorway. Marius was standing, mute, his arms hanging, with the face of a criminal. Monsieur Gillenormand was pacing up and down the length of the room. He turned to his daughter and said to her,
Nothing. It's Monsieur Marius. Say hello. Monsieur wants to marry. That's all. Off you go.
The old man's clipped, hoarse tone of voice announced a strange fullness of feeling. The aunt threw Marius a bewildered look, seemed to scarcely recognize him, did not let a movement or a word escape her, and disappeared at a snort of fury from her father faster than a straw scuttled by a hurricane. Meanwhile, old Gillenormand had gone back to lean against the mantelpiece.
Marry, at 21. You've arranged it. You've nothing left to do now but to ask my permission, a mere formality. Do have a seat, monsieur. Well now, you've been through a revolution since the last time I had the honor of seeing you. The Jacobins came out on top. You must have been happy about that. Aren't you a Republican, since you are a baron? You are made for each other. The Republic must be the icing on the cake of our barony. Were you decorated for July? Did you help storm the Louvre a little, monsieur? Very close to here, Rue Saint-Antoine, opposite the Rue des Nonardiers, there is a cannonball lodged in the third-story wall of a house with this inscription, July 28, 1830. Go and have a look at it. That makes a good impression. Ah, they do such nice things, don't they, your friends? Speaking of which, aren't they putting up a fountain to replace the monument of Monsieur le Duc de Berry? And so just like that, you want to get married. To whom? May one ask without being indiscreet. To whom?
He paused. But before Marius had a chance to answer, he erupted violently.
For heaven's sake, do you have any standing, a fortune behind you? How much do you make in the legal profession?
Nothing, said Marius, with an almost fierce firmness and resolve.
Nothing. All you have to live on is the 1,200 livres I give you?
Marius did not answer. Monsieur Gillenormand continued.
So I take it the girl is rich?
Like me.
What? No dowry?
No.
Any expectations?
I think not.
Not a rag on her back? And what does the father do?
I don't know.
And what is her name?
Mademoiselle Fauchelevent.
What?
Fauchelevent. Went the old man.
Monsieur,
cried Marius.
Monsieur Gillenormand cut him off in the tone of a man talking to himself.
That's right, 21 years old, no standing, 1,200 livres a year. Madame la Baronne Pommerci will go and ask for 2 sous worth of parsley at the fruit seller's.
Monsieur, Marius cut in wildly, now clutching at the last vanishing straw of hope.
I beg you, I beseech you in heaven's name, I join my hands together in prayer, monsieur. I throw myself at your feet, allow me to marry her.
The old man let out a laugh, shrill and grim, through which he coughed and spoke.
Ha, ha, ha! You said to yourself, damn it, I'll have to go and look up that doddering old fogey, that dribbling old goat. What a pity I'm not 25 yet. What a nice, respectable notice. I'd chuck him then. How well I'd make do without him. Never mind, I'll say to him, old noodle, you are only too happy to see me. I want to marry. I want to marry Mademoiselle Nobody, daughter of Monsieur Nothing. I have no shoes. She has no chemise. No matter. I want to throw my career to the dogs, my future, my youth, my life. I want to sink into destitution with a wife around my neck. That's what I have in mind. You must consent. And just like that, the old fossil will consent. Go to it, my boy, as you will. Tie your millstone round your neck. Marry your pousse-levant, your coupe-levant. Never, monsieur, never.
Father,
never!
At the tone in which that never was uttered, Malus lost all hope. He rose and slowly crossed the room, head bowed, unsteady on his feet, more like a man about to die than one taking his leave. Monsieur Gillenormand followed him with his eyes, and the moment the door opened and Malus was about to go out, he darted forward 4 steps with that senile vivacity imperious and spoiled old men have, grabbed Marius by the collar, marched him back energetically into the room, threw him into an armchair and said to him,
"Tell me about it."
It was that single word, father, escaping Marius's lips, that had brought about this revolution. Marius stared at him, amazed. Monsieur Gillenormand's mobile face no longer expressed anything other than a rough and ineffable bonhomie. The stern ancestor had made way for the grandfather.
Come on, let's talk. Tell me about your love life. You chatterbox, tell all. Heavens, what geese these young men are.
Father,
said Marius once more. The old man's whole face lit up with an indescribable radiance.
Yes, that's the way. Call me father, and you'll see.
There was now something so good, so soft, so open, so paternal in this brusqueness that Marius was made dizzy and almost drunk by the sudden shift from discouragement to hope. He was sitting near the table. The light from the candles brought out the dilapidated state of his clothes, and old Father Gillenormand was studying them, flabbergasted.
Well then, father, said Marius.
For heaven's sake, Monsieur Gillenormand broke in. You really haven't got a sou, have you? You're rigged out like a thief.
He fumbled in a drawer and pulled out a purse, which he put on the table.
Here, there's 100 louis. Buy yourself a hat.
Father,
Marius ploughed on,
my good, dear father, if you only knew. I love her. You can't imagine. The first time I saw her was in a Luxembourg. She used to go there. In the beginning, I didn't pay her much attention, and then, I don't know how it happened, but I fell in love with her. Oh, how unhappy it made me. In the end, well, now I see her every day at her place. Her father doesn't know. Imagine they are about to go away. We see each other in the garden in the evening. Her father wants to take her away to England, so I said to myself, I'll go and see my grandfather and tell him all about it. I'd go mad first. I'd die. I'd get sick. I'd throw myself in the river. I absolutely have to marry her. I'd go mad otherwise. So, well, that's the whole truth. I don't think I've left anything out. She lives in a garden where there's a gate, Rue Plumet. That's over by the Invalides. Old Father Gillenormand had sat down next to Marius, beaming with joy. While listening to him and savoring the sound of his voice, he savored at the same time a good long pinch of snuff. At the words Rue Plumet, he stopped inhaling and let the rest of his snuff fall on his knees.
Rue Plumet? You say Rue Plumet? Let me see now. Ah, B, isn't there a barracks over that way? Yes, that's it. Your cousin Théodule has told me about her. You know, the lancer, the officer. A peach, my dear friend, a peach. Lordy, yes, Rue Plumet. It's what used to be called the Rue Blomet. Now it's coming back to me. I've heard talk about this lass at the gate of Rue Plumet. In a garden, a real Pamela. Nothing wrong with your taste.
They say she's nice and clean. Between you and me, I think that nincompoop of a Lancer had a try at wooing her. I don't know how far it went. When it comes down to it, that's neither here nor there. Besides, you can't take him at his word. He's such a braggart. Marius, I think it's wonderful that a young man like you should be in love. You're the right age for it. I like you better in love than a Jacobin. I like you better smitten by a skirt, by Jove, by 20 skirts, than by Monsieur Robespierre. For my part, I must admit that the only sans-culottes I've ever loved are the women. Pretty girls are pretty girls, for pity's sake. There's nothing wrong with that. As for this little lass, she sees you behind Papa's back. That's how it should be. I've had affairs like that myself, too, more than one. Do you know what you do? You don't go in too hard. You don't go asking for trouble. No talk of a wedding and Monsieur le Maire and his sash. You've got a head on your shoulders, use it. It's as simple as that. You have to show some common sense. Err by all means, mortals, but do not marry. You come and find the grandfather, who's not a bad old stick at heart, and who always has a few rolls of louis lying around in an old drawer, and you say to him, Grandfather, this is how it is, and the grandfather says it's quite simple. Youth profits and old age provides. I was young once, and one day you will be old. Go to it, my boy. You'll hand this on to your grandson. Here are 200 pistoles. Have fun, for heaven's sake. Nothing better. That's how the business should be conducted. Don't marry, but don't let that stop you. Do you get my meaning?
Marius, absolutely dumbstruck, unable to articulate a single sound, shook his head to say no. The old man burst out laughing, gave him a wink of his tired old eye, and a rap on the knee, looked him straight in the eye, beaming mysteriously, and told him, with the most affectionate shrug of the shoulders,
Make her your mistress, you silly goose.
Marius blanched. He had not been able to make head or tail of anything his grandfather had just been saying. That rigmarole about the Rue Blomet, Pamela, barracks, lancers, had gone over his head. Nothing of such a fantasy could have any bearing on Cosette, who was as pure as a lily. The old man was rambling, but this rambling had ended in a word Marius understood only too well, a word that was a mortal insult to Cosette. That phrase, make her your mistress, stabbed the strict young man's heart like a sword. He stood up, picked up his hat, which was on the floor, and walked to the door with firm and assured tread. There he turned round, bowed deeply to his grandfather, lifted his head high again, and said, 5 years ago you insulted my father. Today you insult my wife. I will never ask you for anything again, monsieur. Adieu. Old Gillenormand, stupefied, opened his mouth, reached out his arms, attempted to get up, but before he could utter a word, the door had shut again, and Marius was gone. The old man remained for a few moments without moving, and, as though thunderstruck, he could not talk or breathe, as though a fist was closing around his gullet. Finally, he tore himself out of his armchair, ran to the door as fast as a person can run at 91, flung it open, and yelled, Help! Help! His daughter appeared, then the servants. He shouted at them with a terrible rattle in his voice. Run after him! Catch him! What did I do to him? He's gone mad! He's going! Oh, my God! Oh, my God! This time he won't come back! He rushed to the window that looked on the street, opened it with his shaky old hands, leaned out down to the waist while Basque and Nicolette held him from behind and cried, Marius! 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 But Marius was already out of hearing, was at that very moment turning the corner of the Rue Saint-Louis. The old man clapped his hands on his temples two or three times, in anguish, turned away from the window, and flopped into an armchair, pulseless, speechless, tearless, nodding his head and moving his lips like a half-wit, with nothing left in his eyes or his heart but a deep, mournful sensation that resembled night. Book 9. Where are they going? Jean Valjean. That same day, at around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Jean Valjean was sitting alone on the shady side of one of the most solitary slopes in the Champ de Mars. Either out of prudence, or a desire to gather his thoughts, or quite simply as a result of one of those imperceptible changes of habit that creep little by little into all our lives, he now only went out with Cosette fairly rarely. He was wearing his working men's jacket and trousers of coarse gray cotton, and his cap with the long peak hid his face. He was now easy and happy where Cosette was concerned. What had frightened and disturbed him for a while had blown over. But for a week or two now, worries of a different kind had been plaguing him. One day, as he was strolling along the boulevard, he had caught sight of Thénardier. Thanks to his disguise, Thénardier had not recognized him, but since then, Jean Valjean had seen him again several times, and he now felt sure that Thénardier had adopted the quartier as his new hunting grounds. This had been enough for him to make a momentous decision. For Thénardier to be there, hanging around, meant every shade of peril at once. On top of this, Paris was stirring. For anyone who had something in his life to hide, the political turmoil offered this disadvantage, the fact that the police had become extremely nervous and extremely jumpy, and that in their efforts to track down men like Pépin or Moret, they could well uncover a man like Jean Valjean. On all fronts, he had something to worry about. Lastly, he had just stumbled across something inexplicable to add to his alarm, and he was still reeling from it. The morning of that very day, being the only one up and about in the house, and taking a stroll in the garden before Cosette's shutters opened, he had suddenly spotted this line carved into the wall, probably with a nail, 16 Rue de la Verrerie. It was quite recent. The nicks were white in the old black mortar, and a clump of nettles at the foot of the wall was powdered with fine fresh plaster. It had probably been written there during the night. What was it? An address? A signal for others? A warning to him? Whatever the case, it was clear that the entry to the garden had been forced and that unknown people were getting in. He remembered the odd incidents that had already had the household on alert. While his mind kept working on this strange tapestry, he was careful not to mention to Cosette the line written on the wall with a nail for fear of frightening her. After carefully considering and weighing all this up, Jean Valjean had decided to leave Paris, and even France, and go over to England. He had warned Cosette. Within a week, he wanted to be gone. He sat on the slope in the Champ de Mars, turning all sorts of ideas around in his mind. Thénardier, the police, this strange line written on the wall, the voyage, and the difficulty of getting himself a passport. While he sat mulling over these concerns, he saw from a shadow cast by the sun that somebody had just stopped on the crest of the slope immediately behind him. He was about to turn round when a piece of paper folded in four landed on his knees as though a hand had thrown it over his head. He took the piece of paper, unfolded it, and read these two words written in capital letters in pencil. Clear out. Jean Valjean shot to his feet. But there was no one now on the slope. He looked all around and saw a strange-looking creature, bigger than a child, smaller than a man, dressed in a grey smock and a pair of dun-coloured velveteen trousers, leaping over the parapet and sliding down into the ditch that ringed the Champ de Mars. Jean Valjean went home immediately, deep in thought. Marius. Marius had left Monsieur Gillenormand's in desolation. He had gone there with pretty small hopes. He left with immense despair. Still, and those who have observed the first stirrings of the human heart will understand this, the lancer, the officer, that nincompoop, good old cousin Théodule, had left no shadow in his mind. Not the slightest. A playwright might be tempted to hope for a few complications arising out of such a revelation made to the grandson by the grandfather, out of the blue. But what the drama would gain, the truth would lose. Marius was at that age when you believe nothing bad, the age when you believe everything you hear comes later. Suspicions are nothing more than wrinkles. Those in the first flush of youth don't have any. What devastates Othello is water off a duck's back to Candide. Suspect Cosette. There was a whole host of crimes Marius would have committed more easily than that. He began wandering the streets, the resort of those in pain, thinking of nothing he could later remember. At 2 in the morning, he went home to Courfeyrac's and threw himself on his mattress, fully clothed. The sun was high in the sky when he fell into that awful, heavy sleep where your brain goes on working. When he woke up, he saw Courfeyrac, Enjolras, Fouilly,